Good.
So, I haven't talking about Spirit Liquid for too long, so I decided I better talk about something else today. So I decided to choose this topic of non-equilibrium quantum critical behavior. So my purpose today is not so much to present the most recent story. My purpose today is to introduce the subject to you. So if I can make that, then I think I'll be happy. So I try to be pedagogical as possible. Okay, yeah. Okay. So here is the general question. So if we are talking about non-equilibrium quantum system, then what kind of questions may be interesting? You can ask this kind of general question. So for example, you can think about say the effect of non-equilibrium drive in your equilibrium quantum critical point. For example, imagine that. In equilibrium system, I already have some quantum critical point. So quantum critical point is nothing but the point where, you know, there is a transition from one quantum ground state to the other quantum ground state. Yeah? So we have several examples like that. But then you can imagine, like, what if I apply some non-equilibrium drive? I can, say, shine the light. I can apply electric field. In various ways, I can drive the system out of equilibrium. So then what happens to those equilibrium quantum critical point. Perhaps more interesting situation is where you can drive the non-equilibrium phase transition, even if when there's no equilibrium transition. Right? That will be even more interesting. So if that's the case, then how do you understand universality classes? For example, for equilibrium phase transition, we sort of understand how to classify universality classes of the transition. So can we do that for non-equilibrium case? And you immediately realize that you can perhaps generate many more interesting situations, because non-equilibrium drive itself can break some basic symmetries, like, you know, you may be breaking time-reversal symmetry, or you may be breaking invariant symmetry, say, by applying an electric field, for example. So another question that a lot of people are asking is whether the effect of non-equilibrium drive is like effective temperature or not. So, for example, the effect of the temperature near quantum critical point is usually like to decohere the quantum coherence. You basically lose your coherence by heating up the system. Yeah. So, if you think about the non-equilibrium drive as an effective temperature, then basically your non-equilibrium drive should provide a decoherence. And so that you basically destroy the quantum coherence. So you can ask how general this concept may be, because in the literature there are a lot of discussions about you know, thinking about the non-equilibrium drive and effective temperature and how they are related to thermal transitions, right? So in order to answer some of these questions, it will be very useful to come up with some sort of renormalization group theory, because for equilibrium transition, that's the way that we understand the university classes of transition. The question is, can we design a renormalization group theory for non-equilibrium case? So these are the kind of questions we are asking. So in this talk, I'll be focusing on a particular example of equilibrium and non-equilibrium transition. So I will start with equilibrium magnetic quantum phase transition. So this is in itinerant magnet. So this is called the Hertzsimelius-Moreira theory. So I put the Moreira's name there to make our Japanese friend happier. But sometimes it's called the Hertzsimelius theory in North America in particular. But this is a transition from itinerant ferromagnet to itinerant paramagnet. So, and there's a well-defined theory for that. So then we'll be sort of adding a non-equilibrium drive. In fact, we'll be biasing this system so that I let the current flow in the system. And we can do that by applying electric field. And then see what happens. And this is typically has to be an open system. Sorry. And meaning that my system is coupled to reservoir. The reason why I want to do that is if I set up a current and if my system is not coupled to the reservoir, then basically you are heating up the system. You need some place where you can dump your heat. Yeah? So the reason why I want to do this is because I want to have a steady state non-equilibrium state. So general non-equilibrium state is very difficult to treat. So I don't want that. You know, that's too complicated. But the steady state can be achieved by coupling your system to the reservoir. Then I can maintain a steady state by dumping heat to the reservoir system. And under that case, under that situation, I will like to develop the renormalization group scheme. And by doing so, I like to understand the university classes. Okay, so these are the people involved in the work. So Takei was my graduate student. He was a postdoctoral fellow at MPI Stuttgart. He's now a postdoctoral fellow at Maryland. Aditi Mitra was a postdoctoral fellow, and she's now an assistant professor at NYU. And the Willis, you know, and William Witcher Krempa is my current graduate student. So some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about is an old work, and some of the story is relatively new. Okay, so I'm not the only one who studied problems like this. For example, Dennis studied a similar problem in the past. So, and there are various studies of, you know, the effect of non-equilibrium drive, you know, equilibrium quantum critical point. You know. But every work is slightly different, so it's not the same. Okay, so here's the situation. So we understand that I can have a quantum phase transition from one ground state to the other by changing some control parameter. Say you can change pressure, magnetic field, the chemical doping. So today I'll be focusing on phase diagram like this. So at zero temperature, I have a transition from Eitingen ferromagnet to Eitingen paramagnet. And there's a quantum critical point there, t equals zero. But now I heat up the system, then we understand that the finite temperature transition from ferromagnetic metal to paramagnetic metal is a classical transition. Okay? So it must be the case that there's a classical to quantum crossover. It's somewhere in between. Yeah? And we understand how this happens. And this is the standard scenario. So basically, when you have a quantum phase transition at t equals zero, then basically you have a strong spatial and temporal correlation. So when you talk about classical transition, then typically we talk about the correlation in space, not so much the correlation in time. But obviously for quantum transition, temporal and spatial correlations are interlocked. So you have to worry about the correlation time as well as correlation length. And in fact, the correlation time typically scales like correlation length to the some power z, and this z is called the dynamical critical exponent. So that's the reason why this entire system behaves as if they live in a much higher dimension, like a d plus z. Yeah? So time acts like a g extra spatial dimension. And typically, that's the reason why your effective dimension is bigger than spatial dimension d. you can define a characteristic energy scale like this. Omega star is a characteristic energy scale associated with the quantum critical point. So that scales like a correlation length to the minus z power, because 1 over xi is a momentum, right? So energy is momentum to the g power. So if this characteristic energy scale is bigger than temperature, or the correlation time is smaller than 1 over temperature, then you are in the quantum regime. Basically, the situation is controlled by zero temperature physics. On the other hand, if a characteristic energy is smaller than temperature, or your correlation time is bigger than 1 over temperature, then you enter a more classical regime. Sometimes this is called quantum critical regime. So where temperature basically acts as a cutoff to your correlation length. Yeah? So this is the way that you can have a crossover from classical regime to quantum regime. So I will explain that. In quantum transition, spatial and temporal fluctuations are coupled. So especially in the case of Eitingen magnet, there is an effective theory people propose in the literature. So basically, what you want to do is you would like to construct some generalization of Ginzburg-Landau theory, but including spatial correlation. Yeah. So if you remember how equilibrium phase transition is described by looking at, say, Landau free energy, and this is the free energy functional, say, in terms of magnetization order parameter. So there's a gradient term, then there's a mass term, and there's an interaction term. And if the sign of the mass term changes sign, then we know that I have a phase transition. Yeah? So we generalize that to quantum situation where now you can see that my frequency scale scales like momentum to the g power. So that's why this g is called dynamical critical exponent. And here, since we have itinerant magnet, what you want to do is you want to integrate out the gapless fermionic degree of freedom. Then I like to construct the effective theory only in terms of order parameter field. So basically, this magnetization variable. Yeah? So this is the theory in terms of magnetization field, and this is nothing but the inverse dynamical susceptibility. So if you look at the static limit of this action, say omega equals zero limit, then you immediately realize that Q square just gives you gradient square, and delta is just a mass term. And in fact, if delta changes sign, you get into a phase transition to a ferromagnetic state. But what is important here is that because of the fact that my order parameter is coupled to conduction electron, basically you generate an overdamped dynamics for the magnetization. Basically what happens is that when your magnetization tries to propagate across the system, you generate lots of particle hole excitation so that your magnetization gets damped. Yeah? So you get overdamped dynamics. And because of that, your dynamical critical exponent is not just one. So for example, if you have a clean ferromagnet or a dirty ferromagnet, this damping coefficient gamma turns out to be proportional to Q or Q square. And if you're an open system, namely if your ferromagnet is coupled to the reservoir, then it turns out that its damping coefficient is some constant. So it turns out that this constant is nothing but the tunneling rate between your system and the reservoir. And that's the way that you acquire the dynamics. So depending on different situation, you end up with different dynamical critical exponents. So for example, for clean ferromagnet, I get omega by Q damping. It's the usual Landau damping. Then notice that basically your frequency scale is like QQ. That's why the dynamical critical exponent has to be 3 in that case. So in principle, depending on the system, you can change the dynamical critical exponent. Any question so far? So, yeah. So according to standard renormalization group analysis, this quartic term, namely the interaction between the magnetization mode, becomes irrelevant if your effective dimension is bigger than 4. It's relevant when effective dimension is smaller than 4. So this is just a standard, RG argument. But you know that typically Z is bigger than 1, right? G is either 3 or 4, even 2. So typically your effective dimension is typically bigger than 4, right? So quite often you end up with just Gaussian theory. The fight to the fourth term becomes irrelevant. But on the other hand, temperature turns out to be a relevant perturbation. So this is the renormalization group equation for temperature. So near the quantum phase transition, temperature is not just a parameter. It's actually a running coupling constant. Yeah? So it has a scaling dimension of Z. So in fact, temperature scales like the energy scale of your problem. So that's why the engineering dimension of this operator temperature is given by Z. So what we understand is that basically when you increase temperature, since temperature is relevant perturbation near the quantum critical point, basically thermal fluctuation decouples dynamics and statics. So at the end of the day, basically what happens is that your quantum coherence is destroyed, and that's the way that this transition at finite temperature becomes classical. So you understand that. And using renormalization group theory, we understand the entire crossover. For example, if you are in this quantum critical regime or Gaussian classical regime, depending on the literature, so basically what happens is that your correlation length diverges as some power law in temperature. Yeah? So temperature acts like a cutoff to your correlation length. Because if temperature is zero, then basically your correlation length is infinity. So you approach this critical point of finite temperature, you find that correlation length diverges as t goes to zero. And then there's a crossover regime you can determine by using renormalization group theory. So I don't want to go into detail, but that's basically what happens. So again, in the quantum regime, basically everything is described by t equals zero theory. But at finite temperature, you have to take into account temperature effect much more significantly. Okay, so here is a situation that we like to understand. Okay, so I explained to you that in the equilibrium situation, I have a zero temperature transition like this. Then the effect of temperature, you know, basically is to give you a decoherence for quantum coherence. So at the end of the day, this transition becomes classical. So now the question is, so imagine that I have a system here. I'm thinking about a two-dimensional system that can already have a phase transition, say, from ferromagnet to paramagnet by tuning some parameters. But then let me attach lead on the left-hand side, right-hand side, and I'm going to let the current flow across the system. So now my system is coupled to the reservoir. Then I have a driving current. Yeah. So I have I generate a non-equilibrium situation. Yeah. So J is my non-equilibrium drive near such a quantum critical point.
Decoherence, you need the reservoir. So the reason why we like to have reservoir is I like to create a steady state system. It's very important. And you don't have the coherence anymore. But so I'm asking, you wouldn't have the coherence if the system is away from equilibrium but isolated.
Yeah, it would still preserve coherence if it's not coupled to anything else. If it's a closed system.
Yeah,
it's just that I'm only talking about steady state system. Yeah. If the system is isolated, not coupled to the reservoir, then basically you cannot have a steady state. Yeah. But then, you know, it has its own quantum dynamics. So it's quite different from an open system like this.
Yeah.
The situation is quite different.
Sure.
Yeah. But this way, I can make a connection to the equilibrium situation more nicely. Yeah. Because this is, you know, again, the steady state still has some characteristic of the equilibrium system. So that I can make an adiabatic connection to equilibrium situation. Because what I want to do is, so previously, I've been mostly talking about a temperature effect near the quantum critical point. I told you that it's relevant perturbation. In fact, it decoherent the quantum coherence, right? So you may ask, okay, what if I apply a voltage across the system? And does it do the same thing? Or are you generating a totally different situation? So the answer is not obvious. The answer is not obvious. Yeah. Okay. So here's a little more detail. So this is kind of very simple setup. I'm thinking about a thin two-dimensional system, and I take the three-dimensional lead, and I let the current flow. So I have some electrons hopping around the layer degree of freedom. This is my system. And then, particle can tunnel to the lead. Right? So I have 2D itinerant system to couple to two three-dimensional leads. And in order to make our life simple, I'll be talking about an Ising limit for the magnetic transition, so the Ising magnet. But then I will talk about the Heisenberg case later. Okay, so now if you try to understand such a non-equilibrium situation, then you need to immediately encounter difficulty because the original Hertzsimilius-Moria theory is based on quantum generalization of Landau-Ginzburg free energy. Yeah, so you need something like free energy, or you need something like effective action. Yeah, but this is all equilibrium concept. Yeah, we write it down such a thing, the partition function. In functional integral, right? So we would like to do a renormalization group on that. But this is an equilibrium concept. You cannot easily generalize it. So you have to find a way to express non-equilibrium problem. And there's a well-defined way of doing that. This is using Feynman passing integral formulation. But this is some of our histories on the so-called Keldysh time control. And I'll try to explain that. So, in order to determine the nature of the quantum transition in the non-equilibrium situation, we have to generalize this renormalization group scheme. Then we are going to do that using this Keldysh functional integral. Okay, so why do we need that? So why the non-equilibrium situation is so much different from equilibrium situation? So here's an argument. So imagine that I like to compute some expectation value of some operator, yeah, in time. But typically, I can do that by taking a trace of operator and density matrix, right? Yeah. So density matrix, the time-dependent density matrix can be written like this using time evolution operator. Yeah. So and then I can write that like this. This is a trivial statement. So my initial density matrix is some t equal minus infinity. Then I have a time evolution up to say time t. So therefore, I can write this operator like this. So my time-dependent density matrix looks like that. I just copy this equation there. Then because this is a trace operation, I can move this operator to the left-hand side. So I can do that. Yeah. So the reason why this expression is nice is because this is written a time sequence. So I start from minus infinity, initial condition. Then I do the time evolution of the time t. Then I measure this operator O. Then it evolves time again. But notice that when I do that, that I go from minus infinity to time t, then I have to go back to minus infinity. Yeah? So in general, when you evaluate an expectation value like this, it actually involves forward and backward time evolution. Yeah? This is pretty general, independent of whether you're dealing with the equilibrium situation, non-equilibrium situation, okay? But in the equilibrium case, we can avoid this, yeah? Remember that in equilibrium field theory, we don't have to think about forward evolving time and, you know, backward time evolution, right? So the reason why we can avoid that in equilibrium is as follows. So typically, if you're interested in, say, computing expectation value of some operator, so again, the same thing. This is time evolution operator. Zero means basically I can start with some state I know, then I adiabatically turn on my interaction starting from minus infinity. Yeah? So you can think about a free particle system at t equal minus infinity. I adiabatically turn on my interaction at t. So then I can basically calculate this expectation value. So my ground state is just a consequence of starting from some state and doing some time evolution. So typically, in equilibrium field theory, we argue that we can turn on my interaction adiabatically, right? Then I can also turn off my interaction adiabatically at t equal infinity. So that's typically the assumption. For example, if you look at Mahan's book on many particle physics, they always do that. They use this argument, right? So when you do so, then basically assumption is that, you know, imagine that now I do the time evolution from minus infinity to plus infinity. So minus infinity, I know the state I'm starting with. I turn on interaction, I turn off the interaction, and by the time you turn off the interaction at plus infinity, the assumption is that the resulting state is basically the same state. Yeah? And it's only differ by some phase factor. That's all you can have. So at the end of the day, you know, the time evolution from minus infinity to plus infinity only gives you some phase factor. Otherwise, it's basically the same state. So that's the underlying assumption. Right. So, but that's typically the assumption in the equilibrium field theory, yeah? So if you do that, then you immediately realize that the life is very simple because I take this, yeah? Then I can just add. So here I have a time evolution from t to minus infinity, but I can extend that to plus infinity. I just have to take into account this phase factor. So I do this time evolution to infinity, then I just divide that by some phase factor, and that's it, yeah? So if you do that, then you can rewrite it like that. So you have a matrix element from minus infinity to plus infinity. Your operator is acting on at time t, but then you just have to normalize it. This is the asymmetric theory you encounter in any quantum. So look at any quantum field theory book. They always do that. Yeah, they always do that. So the underlying assumption is that you know, in distant future, when time is plus infinity, you know, when you turn off your interaction, it's basically the same state with up to phase factor. Yeah. So if you do that, then basically you have a nice expression of only in terms of forward moving time branch. Yeah. You just have to worry about going from minus infinity to plus infinity. That's all you need. So we don't have to worry about going back in time. Yeah? So this is not true in non-equilibrium situation. You can't do that. Yeah, we don't know what happens in the future. Sounds familiar? But that's what happens in non-equilibrium, right? we don't know. Yeah, when we turn off the interaction in the distant future, we don't know whether that's the same state or not. Lots of things can happen. Lots of things may depend on the initial condition. So we don't know that. Yeah. So, but this formula is still general, right? The first formula I wrote down, it doesn't depend on that assumption. So I can still use that. I can still use this formula. You know, basically going from minus infinity to t, then go back to the minus infinity. But I can extend this further. Basically, I can, But then notice that what I can do is instead of going back at time t to minus infinity, I can go all the way to plus infinity and come back. It doesn't make any difference because if I combination of this and that is basically time evolution from t to minus infinity, right? So I can go back. I can go all the way to plus infinity and come back. Yeah. So that's Keldysh contour. So I start from some minus infinity time, then go all the way to distant future, then go back. And if I think about time evolution along this contour, and if I can evaluate that expression, and that's it. That's my expectation value. That's basically non-Eulerian quantum statistical mechanics. That's the way that it has to be done. Yeah? So one way to think about this problem is to use a so-called Keldysh generating functional. So I can write down some generating function like this. So U sub C means I'm thinking about time evolution along this Keldysh contour with the initial density matrix at t equal minus infinity. Then I can add a source term at time t in such a way that if I take the derivative of, say, logarithm of this generating function with respect to the source term, I basically generate this expectation value. So what it does is just, you know, in the Hamiltonian, in the time motion operator, basically, you just select this particular operator at time t. So it comes down like that. Yeah? That's all there is, just like an equilibrium case. But you have to consider Keldysh time contour. That's the main difference. Okay. So again, I like to reiterate that equilibrium field theory is based on this assumption that the state at the distant future is basically, you know, it's the same as the initial state of the phase vector, which is not true. And out of equilibrium, this assumption is invalid. In fact, we have no knowledge of the asymptotic state in the distant future. Yeah? We only know the initial condition. So that's the reason why this formulation works. Basically, you let the quantum system evolve forward in time. Yeah? Then let them rewind this evolution back. But then you don't need to know what happens in the distant future. What you do, you take into account all possible outcomes in the future in your past integral. The sum over histories, including whatever happens in the future, then I don't need to know that because everything is in the generating function. Make sense? Yeah? It's within the history. I'm taking into account every outcome in the future in my generating function because I'm including everything, right? I just need to know the initial condition. Yeah? So I explained to you that this is the basically, I can think of that as a non-Eulerian version of partition function, if you like. Okay. So then I can basically play the same game like what we do for the Feynman path integral. We basically divide the time evolution into infinitesimal step. Yeah, then I sum them up, yeah? Just like just like the way that we calculate partition function in the equilibrium case. Yeah, so for example, here I show you the example, the n equal 3 case. So I divide the entire time machine into, say, 3 pieces. I just have to take into account the fact that I have to come back. So I have a forward time branch here, then I have a backward time branch. So once you do that, it just corresponds to summing over all histories. Summing over all histories of some field living on the forward time branch, some field living on the backward time branch. And there is some weighting factor, yeah, for each pass. So I'm summing over all configurations like that. So that is your sort of non-Eulerian version of partition function. Yeah? It's a generating functional, to be more precise. Does it make sense? So you use that. So there is no free energy here. Logarithm of G is not free energy because there's no such a thing, but it still acts like a generating functional. Yeah. So what's good? Yeah. So this set up the stage, right? Now I can go into the main story. Good. Okay. But my problem is much more complicated. My problem is some interacting fermion in field theory. You know, I have an interacting fermion that can give us like transition from ferromagnet to paramagnet. Yeah. So I have an interacting fermion system. So again, I can define fermionic field on the forward time branch and fermionic field on the backward time branch. I have to sum up all histories of that. So then I like to express everything in terms of order parameter field. I like to come up with an effective field theory of order parameter. But if you remember the way it works in equilibrium, basically your fermions are coupled to the order parameter. Then you use some kind of Hubbard-Strunz shift decoupling. We integrate our fermions, and you generate effective action in terms of order parameter field. You can do the same. It's just that you have to do that on the non-equilibrium, on the Kaldish time contour. So you use that. Then you just integrate our fermion. You end up with an effective field theory in terms of order parameter. In this case, magnetization variable. So again, the magnetization variable may live on a forward time branch or backward time branch. But then you have some of all configurations of such a case. So some of the history basically becomes functional integral. So you just have to end up with functional integral of magnetization variable in forward and backward time branch. This is basically the theory that you want to work with. Yeah. So suppressing all the details, basically this is what you end up with. So instead of magnetization variables in forward and backward time branch, it turns out that it's much more useful to think about symmetric and anti-symmetric, a combination of those. So symmetric combination is called the classical field. So anti-symmetric combination is called quantum field. The reason is very simple. If you don't have any fluctuations in time, then your quantum field will be zero, right? Yeah. So this can only be finite when you have a fluctuation of the magnetization variable in time. Otherwise, this combination is always zero at any given time. So this M quantum really measures the fluctuation of your magnetization variable. Yeah? Does that make sense? And if you like, this is like an average field. So this is like some classic, more classical variable. So if you do that, then you end up with some effective action. So you have a quadratic degree of freedom and quartic degree of freedom, just like the expansion in Ginzburg-Landau free energy in terms of order parameter. The same thing happens. It's just that you have to take into account both branches, and that's really the only difference. So at the quadratic level, you end up with this. So you're in non-equilibrium, your say inverse propagator, so to speak, or the inverse susceptibility looks more complicated. So you have a retarded part of the inverse susceptibility. If there's something called a Kaldish component. So what actually happens is the Kaldish component really measures the distribution function of your magnetization variable, which doesn't have to follow equilibrium distribution function. It's something much more general. Yeah? But in the equilibrium limit, this is related to the equilibrium distribution function of the order parameter field. Yeah? Okay, so what's that? So it's a bit technical, but I hope that it's understandable. Yeah. So at the end of the day, you have to compute all these quantities. You know, it's actually done in some the non-equilibrium generalization of RPA, if you like. You know, you can do that. So then at the end of the day, this is the inverse retarded susceptibility. Here, this guy actually looks exactly the same as equilibrium. Retarded susceptibility, you know, there's a delta that controls the phase transition. When delta becomes negative, you have a transition. And there's a Landau damping. And there's a gradient square term, right? And here gamma is, as I said, is an open system that is related to the scattering rate between my system and the reservoir. It's basically proportional to scattering rate, to the scattering rate, yeah. Okay. And it turns out that this Kaldish component At the end of the day, it can be written like that at zero temperature. It's gamma is some number. It's the frequency omega plus the chemical potential difference, it's basically the voltage. So if voltage is zero, it's proportional to omega. If omega is zero, then it's proportional to voltage. And delta is a Stoner parameter, namely that it gives you the transition between ferromagnet and paramagnet. And in fact, one can show that this criterion now depends on voltage. Yeah. So the effective U, how about U, that you have to change to have a transition also changes depending on the voltage. Yeah, so I didn't explain the details. Gamma L, gamma right is a transition rate from system to the reservoir. The tunneling rate. Yeah? Tunneling rate. Gamma left is the tunneling rate on the left. Gamma right is tunneling rate on the right. And in fact, all these numbers like gamma, AB, I didn't write down the details. There's some function of these two variables, the tunneling rate. It's a free form. Just reservoir is just free form.
Also the reservoir. So in this case.
Yeah, so in this case, what actually happens is that reservoir.
Just half of the system. It is one half of the system.
No. Reservoir is the lead, remember? My configuration. Yeah. I have a 2D surface state. It couples the reservoir on the right hand side, reservoir on the left hand side. So my reservoir is nothing but my lead. My three dimensional lead I'm attaching to my system. So it serves two purposes. It acts as a lead for chemical potential difference. It also acts as a reservoir, open system. I can exchange number of particles with my reservoir.
Yeah. So is your reservoir supposed to be in equilibrium?
Yeah, my lead is in equilibrium.
Your lead?
Yeah. The only thing that is not in equilibrium in this case is the central layer. Because I should be able to define a chemical potential at different limit. Yeah, to make a well-defined current.
And the coupling is weak or doesn't matter?
The tunneling rate.
Yeah.
Tunneling rate is basically I'm talking about an energy scale that's smaller than the tunneling rate. So my voltage has to be smaller than the tunneling rate. Because in the other limit, basically you approach the clean limit, turns out. But that's a different limit. The dynamics. Yeah? So I'm talking about the energy scale that's smaller than the tunneling rate. So only then the dynamics is given by this omega by gamma dynamics. Notice that in this case, the dynamical critical exponent z is 2. Yeah? But if you go to the other limit, then you get omega by q. That's basically the clean limit. Then your dynamical critical exponent is different. In this case, z equals 3. So I'm looking at the other limit. So a little bit more details. But this expression is too complicated. So at the end of the day, though, the answer is very, very simple, namely that this is just an equilibrium form, but this Kaldish component basically can be summarized as maximum of three quantities. So if depending on whether omega is bigger than temperature, voltage, or voltage is bigger than omega, temperature, you take a maximum of this, and then it's renormalized by some constant. So it's basically proportional to either omega, T, or voltage. Yeah? And notice that important physics here is that this term, this is the coefficient of quantum term. This guy actually acts like a mass term for quantum fluctuation. Yeah? It's basically mass, right? It's an effective energy gap. Yeah? So you can immediately tell that, for example, if you are sitting at T equals 0 and equilibrium situation where voltage is 0, you can see that this guy goes to 0. So there's no mass gap for the quantum fluctuation. So you have a massive, you have a huge quantum fluctuation. You know? That's basically what happens exactly at the quantum critical point. Yeah? Okay? On the other hand, if you turn on finite temperature, you immediately generate a mass gap for quantum fluctuation. In fact, this guy is proportional to temperature, meaning that as I increase temperature, that the mass gap for quantum fluctuation becomes bigger and bigger. So you basically gap out quantum fluctuation. Basically decohere the quantum fluctuation. Yeah? So that's the way that quantum fluctuation is suppressed by temperature. if you're sitting at t equals 0 and if you apply a non-equilibrium bias voltage, then you can see that this guy is now proportional to voltage. Yeah? So you can see the quantum fluctuation is now suppressed by applied bias. But it, you know, again, this comes from the fact that this object actually acts like a mass term for quantum fluctuation. So you can clearly see why you have a decoherence by applying either temperature or voltage from this. Okay, but this is the theory at the Gaussian level. You know, if you get serious, then you have to include the interaction between different modes. You know, you have to think about the effect of the phi to the fourth term in the field theory. So you have to think about a mode coupling. And it turns out that because of the fact that I have to deal with classical and quantum field, the possible quantic term is much more complicated. And in fact, it turns out there are four kinds of quantic term. Yeah? So what that means is that when you do the calculation, you can make lots of mistakes. And in fact, we were making lots of mistakes when we were doing this calculation.
Different in general? I mean, do they have different time and momentum dependence?
Yeah, because they have different energy and temperature dependencies. Yeah. Okay, so then we can work with this realization group scheme to study the effect of mode-mode coupling. Just like the equilibrium case, so you integrate out fluctuations, say, between some cutoff and renormalized cutoff, then you do the rescaling and renormalization. So if you just count the engineering dimension, yeah, then you immediately realize that just like the temperature, voltage also relevant perturbation, yeah, and they actually have the same scaling dimension at the tree level. And delta is obviously a control parameter, so they should have relevant operator. It should be a relevant operator. Then if you look at the effect of this quantic coupling, then again you find that the critical dimension is d plus z, just like the equilibrium case. But what is important here is the voltage is relevant perturbation. But this is tree level, and in order to make a problem, you actually have to do at least one loop calculation, and if you do that, it looks like this, and you don't want to know what it looks like, right? So it's not important. Yeah. But the thing is that you can actually do it. You can do it. There's a way to do, there's a way to add one loop correction to your realization group equation. And in fact, in order to describe the full crossover from quantum to classical regime, you actually need that. But without discussing it, I can still talk about the physics. So here is here is the argument. So quantic interaction is actually formally irrelevant if d plus z is bigger than 4. It's relevant if it's smaller than 4. But this is the same as equilibrium case. But in our case, this is actually a marginal case. This is the most difficult case. What that means is that you have lots of logarithms in your algebra equation. Yeah? So you have to be a little bit more careful, but at the end of the day, at the most naive level, it's very easy to understand what happens. So the point is that at the end of the scaling, you know, you start from some initial condition, you let your algebra equation evolve, and you somehow stop at some point. The point where you have to stop is when this delta, the deviation from critical point, becomes order one number. Yeah, then your algebra equation has to stop, because if you go beyond that, your algebra equation is just not valid anymore, right? So by doing so, you can determine the scale parameter B star. So remember that my delta scales like with the engineering dimension 2. My voltage scales like engineering dimension Z. Yeah? So then I have to stop where this parameter becomes order one number. This fixed B star, the B star looks like that. And this R is nothing but the distance from the critical point. Yeah? So then I just put it back. And then I realize that my voltage at that scale becomes like this. Yeah? So V is my initial voltage. Yeah? Initial voltage. So this is my this is my initial data, right? This is the voltage I have in my system. Okay? So there are two possible situations. So at the end of the scaling, your scaled voltage may become much, much greater than 1. Yeah? Or it can become much, much smaller than 1. Yeah? depending on your initial condition voltage, yeah? Depending on your initial condition. So what that means is that if your initial condition is bigger than, say, R to the G by 2, R is the distance from criticality. So if your voltage is bigger than that, then basically you end up in the classical regime. On the other hand, if my voltage at the end of scaling is much, much smaller than 1, then basically I enter the quantum regime. Quantum regime. Yeah? So that gives us the following phase diagram. So this is my voltage. This is the control parameter. This is the quantum critical point in equilibrium, and voltage is 0. And this, there is a voltage-driven transition. So here is the Aitken ferromagnet. The entire area is Aitken paramagnet. But below this scale, all the physics here is basically described by T equals 0 physics. It's the quantum regime. Above this crossover line, then the physics is basically classical in the sense that you basically destroy your quantum coherence. Yeah? So there, your correlation lengths, is only a function of voltage. It's not a function of, say, the distance from criticality. For example, if you're in the quantum regime, then your correlation length diverges as delta goes to delta C. If you're in the classical regime or quantum critical regime, basically your correlation length is cut off by voltage. So notice that when voltage goes to 0, your correlation length diverges. So there are two different regimes depending on where you start from. Yeah? Where you start from. Does it make sense? Yeah. So that's the way that you can draw a phase diagram like this. Yeah. So another interesting thing is that the question is, what's the nature of this transition at finite voltage? Yeah? Yeah? So one can show that if you get into classical regime, so we are talking about G equal 2. So the classical regime is defined by voltage bigger than, say, delta minus delta C. Then by rescaling your RG equation, one can show that basically you construct an RG equation where the voltage all drops up in the classical regime. What that means is that if you enter that regime, the voltage is not a running coupling constant anymore. It becomes a parameter. Yeah? And then basically it turns out that this RG equation is exactly the same as the classical transition for D equal 2 theory. It just describes the Wilson-Fischer fixed point for the classical transition. So you can actually recover the RG equation for the classical transition, starting from quantum RG equation by entering, you know, after entering the classical regime, you can show that you recover the Wilson-Fischer RG equation. You know? This Fischer is Michael Fischer, not Matthew Fischer. Yeah. So that's the reason why this voltage-driven transition in the classical regime is a classical transition. Yeah, it's not a quantum transition. Okay, so another interesting thing to notice is that, in general, in non-equilibrium, there is not such a thing as a fluctuation dissipation theorem. Yeah? So the equilibrium at finite temperature, we know that, you know, this Keldysh path of susceptibility really measures the fluctuation. The difference between retarded or advanced susceptibility measures the dissipation. So this is called the fluctuation dissipation theorem. And the proportionality constant is given by some Bose factor. You know, it's coming from some combination of Bose distribution function. And at the end of the day, the reason why you can make a relation between fluctuation and dissipation is because there's a detailed balance in equilibrium system. Yeah, detailed balance. But in non-equilibrium, there's no detailed balance. Yeah. So what that means is that if you consider those objects separately, then there's no reason to believe that they should be proportional to each other. In fact, in general, it doesn't, yeah? even in our case. But it turns out that if you go to a classical regime, then it turns out that they become proportional to each other. And the coefficient is given by basically proportional to my voltage. Yeah? So this is analogous to the equilibrium situation where imagine that this is general, imagine that I take, say, temperature much, much bigger than my frequency limit, then this coefficient just becomes temperature divided by omega. Yeah? Sorry, temperature divided by omega, yeah? So in a way, I can think about this voltage and effective temperature. You know, when I go from temperature to the voltage, I just replace temperature by voltage. But this works only in the classical regime where I take, you know, my effective temperature much, much bigger than omega. In general, this is not true. It's not true. Yeah. Does it make sense? Yeah. It's not equilibrium. It's in a steady state. Yeah? But formally...
So what do you mean by... What is the difference between... I mean, it's not thermal equilibrium.
Yes.
All right, but it's, yeah, it's still equilibrium because... It's,
well, there is some sort of generalized, if you like, detailed balance, yeah? But it's not given by Bose factor, so I cannot think of that as really as a detailed balance. It's not detailed balance. It's just that they happen to be proportional to each other. It's just that this voltage acts like an effective temperature in that regime. Because I cannot possibly have things like cotangent hyperbolic of omega by T factor. I never get that. Yeah? Only in this limit it looks like this guy. So another way to understand what's going on is to derive a quantum Langevin equation. So it turns out that you can derive a quantum version of the Langevin equation starting from this Kaldish action. The way to do it, it's a little bit formal, but I'll try to describe this. So remember that this guy acts like a mass term for quantum field. That was an important part of the physics, right? This Kaldish partial susceptibility acts like a mass. I can decouple this formally using some another field like that. It's basically doing a Hubbard-Stronovich transformation to this term. Yeah? Then I take the variation of the Kaldish action with respect to quantum field. Then it turns out that this additional field I'm putting in there by Hubbard-Stronovich transformation actually gives you a noise term for the quantum Langevin equation. So I can derive an equation for classical field. I mean, that's basically the Langevin equation, right? I like to describe the dynamics of classical field. And this is the equation. What quantum part does is to give you a noise. So this is the quantum noise. Yeah? So it's nice because I have a equation of motion for classical field. Now the noise is explicitly given by the quantum part.
How do your results depend on the initial state, the rho minus infinity?
So for steady state, it doesn't depend.
It doesn't depend. Yeah.
So that's basically the assumption. Steady state.
This is not trivial, right?
This is not trivial. In this case, it does. And the reason why it does is we are dealing with an extended system. So, for example, one can show that if you do the similar problems in, say, quantum infinity problem, zero-dimensional problem, that's not necessarily the case. Yeah. You could, for example, you could have more than one steady-state solution. Yeah? But in this case, I think we proved that, I mean, it's not a rigorous proof, but we sort of proved that basically, steady state is unique. You don't generate different kinds of steady state.
So it doesn't depend from the initial.
Right. Yeah. So actually, only then this entire formulation actually works. So this again is still a special case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So more general cases may not be the case. Yeah. But in this case, it does. Yeah. So the noise stuff. This quantum noise is determined by this Kaldish part of the response function. It's part of the response function. Yeah, so this is a good description in both phases, in principle. This is very, very general. Yeah? Because this is just a formal manipulation. Okay. Yeah. Now, the interesting thing is if you go to the classical regime, then your Kaldish part of susceptibility, inverse susceptibility proportional to voltage, as I claim. And because of that, your noise term, basically noise-noise correlator, is proportional to this object. I didn't explain that. So the noise-noise correlator is basically given by your Kaldish susceptibility. So the, all the information about the quantum and classical dynamics is here. All the information about thermal and quantum fluctuations are here. Yeah? And that term in the classical regime becomes proportional to voltage. What that means is that your noise becomes Gaussian wire noise. Yeah? And this is not true in general. It happens only in the classical regime. In the quantum regime, this is not a Gaussian wire noise. It's some kind of colored noise. You know, the space and time intimately connected to each other. In the classical limit, they sort of decouple, and it's proportional to voltage. And this is the same as so-called model A dynamics. Model A dynamics. So this also tells us that this voltage-driven transition is in the same universe class as the usual, say, thermalizing transition. Because what happens in equilibrium is the classical Langevin equation that describes the thermal transition is precisely that with the noise proportional to temperature. So that's called model A dynamics. You recover, you sort of get the same thing for the voltage-driven transition in this particular case. Now, if you you can generalize this to Heisenberg limit. So far we only talked about the Eigen case, but you can also generate this to Heisenberg limit. What that means is that I have to deal with magnetization X, Y, Z component. Then you can derive a Langevin equation for Heisenberg case. Then one can show that, especially in the ordered phase, we can show that we can generate this famous spin precession term in the Landau-Lipschitz-Gilbert equation. We also have so-called spin torque effect. This was discussed in the literature, you know, using all sorts of phenomenological approach. But we can sort of derive that rigorously, starting from non-equilibrium action. So this kind of action, this kind of Langevin equation, was written down by hand, you know, using various arguments in the literature. But the point is that you can actually derive it. And it turns out that this, for example, spin torque term may be responsible for a possible dynamical instability. So what that means is that if the coefficient of this term becomes sufficiently big, then you induce a dynamical instability at finite Q. And after that dynamical instability, you know, the magnetization dynamics may enter, for example, you know, depending on initial condition, it may enter chaotic regime or periodic regime, you know, all these classical dynamics described by Kempe theorem, things like that. So there have been some discussions like this in itinerant ferromagnet, but we can derive such a term. So let me skip that. Yeah. So, but the geometry that I presented to you so far is a little bit unrealistic one. Right? Basically, I have a central layer, and I'm attaching these two leads, left-hand side, right-hand side. But more realistic situation would be like I have a two-dimensional electron system. I apply electric field, but I couple to the bus like this. Yeah? So here, my sort of my bias and bath degree of freedom are not the same. Right? Previously, it's the same thing. But this guy basically mainly acts like a bath, but then I just, you know, apply electric field. I let the current flow in two-dimensional. Huh? This is, again, a free-formium bath. Free-formium bar. So if you do that, then you immediately realize that you are breaking an emergence symmetry. Yeah? And because of that, for example, if you look at the retarded susceptibility, then you immediately generate the tiny susceptibility breaking term like this. So it's now you generate a new term like that. And it turns out that it's also a relevant term. And here, this is called drift term. But this problem is a little bit more complicated than the previous problem, because in this case, you actually have to solve a distribution function in the two-dimensional electron gas more explicitly. You actually have to solve a quantum Boltzmann equation to determine the distribution function. And then using that, you can basically repeat the same analysis. Yeah? And it turns out that, I mean, it's a little bit more complicated, but at the end of the day, the conclusion is basically the same. So it doesn't, you know, the situation doesn't really change much. So at the end of the day, you end up with the quantum Langevin equation. Again, if in the classical limit, your noise is proportional to effective temperature, namely the electric field in this case. Okay. So, okay. So time is almost up. So let me just mention one more thing, then I'll just stop. So far I told you that the voltage acts like effective temperature. So we have a rigorous way of showing that in this particular system. But then you may say, well, this is boring, right? Because then what's new? Because voltage is just like an effective temperature, yeah? So then you can ask, like, does it always do that? Or is there any situation where this breaks down? Yeah? So as I emphasized, this is a very special case. Yeah? So even in this framework, for example, imagine that you generalize your system slightly. So let me just do that. So here, so let me consider, say, two coupled layers, right? I have two 2D gas systems. And only one of them is coupled to the bath. The other one is not coupled to the bath. So there is no exchange of particles between this layer and this bath. Only this guy can exchange the particle with the bath. But they interact with each other. Yeah? Imagine that this is the system. Yeah? So in a way, this system is now, system is still closed in the sense that you're not directly coupled to the bath. But this system is open. So you're basically coupling one open system and one closed system. And they are described by different dynamical critical exponent. So there's some competition between these two different modes, you know, two different degree of freedom. And in fact, one can show that in this case, without going details, it turns out that the effective temperature in equilibrium and effective temperature, that's basically a bias voltage or electric field, is not the same. It's not the same. So when you have more than one order parameter, or when your order parameter has some tensorial structure, yeah? There's more structure in it. In this case, there are more than one degree of freedom, more than one symmetric breaking field. Yeah? Then the effective temperature is not exactly the same, the effective temperature. Yeah? So it is true that even in this case, the main effect of voltage or electric field is to give you the decoherence. But the details are different. For example, the temperature dependence of the correlation length, the magnetic correlation lengths, or the effective temperature dependence of the magnetic correlation lengths are not the same. In this case. So you cannot just replace temperature by effective temperature, even in the classical level. Yeah? Yeah? So the general situation is a little more complicated. So, but I don't want to go into too much detail on that. It's okay. So you have to summarize. We looked at the steady-state non-equilibrium magnetic quantum critical phenomenon in an open system. We managed to generalize RG scheme to non-equilibrium case. And in this particular case, the voltage actually acts like an effective temperature. We have a rigorous way of showing that. But when your order parameter acquires more complicated structure, then the subreading scaling can be different from the equilibrium case. So it's not the same thing. Yeah. So this may be, you know, paving the way to understand the universal classes of non-equilibrium phase transition. Thank you very much for your attention.
So quantum criticality in the experimental system is often measured with resistivity.
Yes.
So which is a non-equilibrium property. So is there any indication of where this is really relevant?
Yeah, for example, you could study a nonlinear transport. Yeah?
Right.
So then the nonlinear transport, you know, the voltage dependence of the nonlinear transport may have a fractional power. Yeah? So, for example, like you can describe that, for example.
Has that been done, you know, at all?
I don't think so. So, we just have to come up with some ideal system like this. Basically, what you need is, you know, I should prepare a system that's already very close to giving you a quantum critical point.
Right.
Yeah? But it's already quite difficult, as you know.
Yeah.
And then I have a way to apply a non-equilibrium drive. I mean, here I describe the effect of bias voltage, but I can imagine, like, thinking about things like shining the light, yeah? Some optics experiment, or you go to some non-linear regime, right? It's not just your optics probe is not just probing stream. You know, you should be able to drive the system out of equilibrium. So there will be like AC-driven non-equilibrium situation and then DC-driven situations. But I expect that a similar thing may actually happen. Yeah. So something like that is necessary. But first, I have to come up with a system where I'm already very close to some quantum kind of quantum critical point. Either say superconductor insulator transition that which we then study some time back. It's one part of the system. Or you may want to look at say metal insulator transition, the metal insulator transition. Mm-hmm. It's another possibility. Or the magnetic transition. Right. But you know that the example of ferromagnetic quantum critical point is very rare. Yeah? Okay. So at the moment or you can study quantum critical point between an anti-ferromagnetic metal to paramagnetic metal. This seems to be more abundant than ferromagnetic case. So another warning sign is that the we now understand that the Hertzsprung-Willis theory could be wrong. Yeah. So here I sort of pretended that it's perfectly fine to use this formulation. Yeah. But it may not be the case. So this is another thing that we should have in mind. Yeah?
Okay, just a second, the following question. Did you study the case in which voltage changes with time?
No, we didn't. Okay, that's one of the things that in my agenda. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's basically what I was thinking about, this H-driven transition. Okay. It's actually more complicated.
I have a question. So in the case in which V really acts like an effective temperature, So you're saying you're in a steady state and all there is no phase coherence, right?
Well, you know.
So does it correspond to the thermal, so do correspond to the thermal expectation values with that effective temperature?
So if you replace both function by the high temperature limit, then yes. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying? So you calculate the expectation by using Bose thermal distribution function.
Yeah.
Yeah. You take temperature, peak temperature limit, say high temperature limit. So in that limit, it looks the same. I would say.
And in the low temperature.
The effective temperature. Yeah, but remember that this effective temperature looks like a temperature only works in the classical realm.
Yeah. So this quantity, if we take it when it's low, it is not like a thermal.
Only in the other level. Yeah. So in that sense, uh-huh. This terminology, effective temperature, is limited.
So can you use it for things like population inversion or something?
I didn't think about that.
Okay.
You mean you're thinking about like voltage driven laser, things like that?
Yeah.
Make a laser out of biasing something.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank you back again.